conservative,
Christian, mother, wife,
Air Force veteran,
gun rights advocate.
This is Stacey on the Right. Here's your host, Stacey Washington.
Welcome to Hour 2 of Stacey on the Right. Welcoming into the program, William Jacobson, founder of Legal Insurrection, Cornell Law School professor. Legal Insurrection is actually one of my favorite websites. It's legalinsurrection.com. Thank you so much, William, for joining me tonight.
Thanks for having me on.
And you're also a professor. So Cornell Law School, that's hardly like that's not a sham operation. So I'm hoping to get some deeper understanding.
I appreciate the vote of confidence.
I'm just saying it's kind of impressive. I'm sure you can toss that around at cocktail parties and get a couple of very appreciative nods off of that. Very difficult to go to Cornell Law School, let alone be a professor there. So I was really interested to see when I realized you'd be joining us tonight. I'm very grateful for your time and also just to hear your thoughts on the four charges against President Trump. So let's start off with just what they mean. I mean, we're lay people. We don't play lawyers on television, although I've watched every season of Law and Order. So maybe I have a little bit that I can pull from. But I mean, in all seriousness, what do these four charges in this third indictment mean?
Well, it all relates to Trump's conduct after the election, but really through January 6th, and to some extent, even the day or two after that. And what the government is claiming that he unlawfully attempted to obstruct the counting of electoral votes. They've got a couple of other charges there, defrauding the United States and conspiracy against rights, conspiracy to deprive people of their vote because of that. But really the core of it is that he did not accept the outcome of the election. He allegedly falsely claimed that it was stolen. And despite people telling him all around him that that wasn't true, and he supposedly conspired with others to have various state electors propose alternate, and in some cases, in one case, I think it was substitute slates of electors. So that's really what it is. It's an attempt to interfere with the counting of the electoral votes.
So then, with those charges, what do you see happening next? And what is the likelihood that a jury of his peers will say, yeah, that's exactly what he did?
Well, next is it'll go through the normal criminal process. I think we'll find out in about 2 to 3 weeks how much of a fast track the judge is going to put this on. If you just read the indictment, it's 45 pages. You could probably pull dozens of identities of potential witnesses from that. They're not necessarily named by their name, but this would be a trial that would be a lengthy trial. This is not going to be a 4-day trial. This is going to involve a lot of testimony. There's a lot of issues as to the legal advice he gave and was he entitled to rely on it? Is it just an excuse he's making? So this is going to be a long trial. So I don't know what this judge is going to do, but particularly with the Florida case scheduled for trial next May, I don't know how this judge is going to get this done before the election. She might. We'll find out. But there's a lot to digest here. There's a lot going on here. So that's what's going to happen with the case. Is a jury going to convict him? Well, unfortunately for him, it's a Washington, D.C. jury where 90%+ of the people voted against Trump. You would hope that you could get a neutral jury that would consider it fairly, and maybe you will. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's going to be a challenge. I think the real question here are going to be what are the legal rulings going to be by the judge, because some of these counts are very weak legally. The, conspiracy against rights, essentially, a Civil War era, statutes to, protect people from losing their voting rights. Does that really apply here? Conspiracy to defraud the United States? That's a stretch of a fraud application of this. And there have been cases, at the Supreme Court level, where those sort of stretches of legal theories have been thrown out. Of course, that's long after a conviction and that's up on appeal. But again, the heart of it is the conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding and the actual obstruction of the proceeding, which is the congressional count of electoral votes.
Okay, so, and I do understand what you mean when you talk about the, like, the length of the process. You know, in the same vein as what I mentioned before, kind of jokingly, we are used to this idea that the case just comes up and it's 2 or 3 weeks and we watch the whole thing on court TV and then it's done, right? The lengthiest, the longest it'll go is like 4 weeks. But that is not the case here because of the complexity of the charges. And also, how is President Trump going to be in two places at once? Because the Mar-a-Lago documents trial is happening in Miami. And if that's slated to happen in May, and this case, even if it started, let's say they were able to somehow miraculously get through all of the discovery and prepare a case for trial in January, it wouldn't be over by May, by what you've just said. So how is he in two places at once? And that's just two of the cases we're talking about. If we bring in the third indictment and if that trial begins it with any speed, you know, how is he supposed to manage all of this?
Well, the Manhattan case, I think the judge there has already said that that would await the outcome of the federal trials. So the Manhattan case is not, which is an absurd case, you know, a legally absurd case, never should have been brought by Alvin Bragg. That's going to come last. There's potentially a Georgia case. I think everybody's expecting that, mm-hmm. again, related to the election. So, that's a problem that these judges are going to have to grapple with, is that you've got a defendant who's going to be potentially in calendar year 2024 going to have three criminal trials and going to be running for president, assuming he's the nominee. But even if he's not, he's going to be running, you know, through June of next year during the primaries. So that this is a real problem. I mean, that's the problem with the feds bringing these cases so close to the election, that it's going to interfere with the election. And then this is whether these are meritorious or not. And I have very strong doubts about the one that was just filed in D.C. My initial take on it is, and of course, we've got to see what evidence they come in with. They're not limited to presenting what's in the indictment. But the indictment reads like an indictment of Donald Trump as a politician, that he lied, he did all these bad things, you shouldn't vote for him. But that's not necessarily criminal. You know, it's, I think a lot of fair-minded people and fair-minded lawyers are looking at this and saying, okay, you say you've proven he did bad things, he lied to people, et cetera, but that's not generally a crime. Generally, politicians lie all the time. Politicians contest elections all the time. Mm-hmm. Politicians try to get other politicians to change their minds all the time. Mm-hmm. None of that is criminal. So I have real doubts here. You know, I don't know about this judge. She's supposed to be very tough on J6 defendants, but this is not technically a J6 case. Trump has not been indicted for incitement of the riot. The riot is mentioned really almost in passing in this 45-page indictment. That's not what he's charged with here. And that's the other legal issue that I have here, which is that the obstruction of the vote count took place during the riot on January 6th. But Trump hasn't been indicted for inciting the riot. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that you're charging him with obstruction of the count when the count was going to go forward, but for the riot. So there's a lot of legal issues here. I don't think, you know, most of these charges should make it to trial, but that's going to be the judge's decision. And it's probably can't be appealed until after the trial. That's the way things go. Now, maybe the appeals court would make an exception in a case like this. But generally speaking, Trump's going to go to trial unless the judge throws these things out. And, you know, he's probably going to be convicted by a D.C. jury, whether fairly or not. So this is a real mess. And to do this in an election year, you know, the feds could have done these earlier because all of the conduct at issue here has to – Alvin Bragg's case is 7-year-old conduct, but he waited till 2023 to bring it, the Manhattan case. These are all conduct that took place, you know, in the last month, basically, of 2020 and the first month of 2021. They could have brought these a year ago. They waited till now. I mean, that makes the whole thing smell very bad.
So the lack of timely bringing of the prosecution, especially when, you know, I know it's a side issue, but it in the minds of regular people who don't have access to, you know, a prodigious amount of legal expertise where we can look at, you know, well, you would normally do this. You would, you know, what's normal in a case like this? We have no idea about that. We're regular people. But I can say when we hear on the news that there are all of these cases in New York City, over 3,000 cases that have never been brought to fruition. Some of them are in the like the charging phase, and some of them they don't even have the full case prepared to go to court. 3,800 of them, and these are rapes, murders, all alleged, obviously, but they're, you know, armed robberies, embezzlements, thefts, all kinds of cases with real victims that have not been tried in Manhattan. It makes you wonder, well, if they weren't trying those, what were they doing? Oh, they were working on indicting Trump, and it still took them 7 years to figure it out. Oh, I know, because 2023 is the year in which he would start running against other people in the primary. And so the best time to bring it would be then. So even so, why couldn't they try those cases? And it's, and this is not, it's not unique to Manhattan. There are other jurisdictions in which they have, you know, a leftist or a person who is a Democrat who is the prosecutor, and they haven't been doing their job. And so you have all these cases that are just sitting and kind of languishing and not being tried. And so the other thing I'm wondering about, and are there no rules that judges have to go by as it pertains to the appearance of impartiality or partiality in a case like the one in D.C., where regardless of her politics and the way she obviously dislikes Trump and anyone who supports him, isn't there a rule of some sort that she is bound by that says that if she has personal connections to any of the players in the case, she should recuse herself?
Well, I don't know that she does have some sort of connection to any of to Trump, or I'm not sure what that connection is.
And it, well, I'm referring to the, well, I'm referring to the news that just came out that she, that so the DC case for January 6th, that judge, well, first of all, she's known to be very harsh on J6 defendants, right? That's she's prosecuting them very harshly. She's not giving any of them any leniency or any kind of like, you're a first time offender. She's treating them all like hardened criminals. But aside from that, she used to work at the law firm at this that Hunter Biden used to work at, and they have overlapping time there. It is not known whether or not they work together or shared cases, but they work there together. And Trump is the opponent to Biden in the political contest. Hunter is his son. There's a lot of back and forth on social media between President Trump and, you know, about Hunter Biden. So the connection to that circle, that they're all in that same circle. And so is the judge. She's not someone who is completely impartial.
Yeah, I think you'd need to know more about that. The mere fact that two people happen to work at the same firm, did they know each other? Did they communicate? Did they have any sort of relationship? Were they even there at the same time? You know, those are things we would have to know. So it would be very fact specific. You know, if a judge has, and of course, Hunter Biden is not a party to this criminal prosecution. So I think it would have to be something substantial, some substantial connection that would either reflect bias or create some appearance of reasonable appearance of bias. I just don't know enough about it. But I think if the mere fact that they might have worked at the same law firm, particularly if it was a large law firm, I think you'd need to have a lot more to disqualify the judge.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, it was something that has been brought up quite a bit. I've talked about it quite a bit here on the show because I was just thinking, what are the chances that out of all the judges, out of all the people who could have anything to do with this case, this judge would have worked at the same firm as Hunter Biden? It just seemed a little too coincidental to me. So you mentioned...
Yeah, well, the way they pick judges in federal courts is it's essentially, you know, random. So he got a bad draw there. He got a bad roll of the dice when he drew this judge. According to people who have practiced before her and, you know, are opining about it. So it was a bad draw.
Well, clearly not. I mean, not many things are going in his favor right now, which is kind of a shame because the things he's being charged with, as you mentioned, are Civil War era type stuff, which it doesn't mean they can't be true, but it does mean that they had to really, really search to find things to charge him with. So can we talk a little bit about discovery? I was reading now that I think this is in the Mar-a-Lago documents case, but I could be wrong, that one of the judges is having, you know, kind of a smack fest down in Miami over the discovery process, things not being shared, et cetera. She's a Trump-appointed judge, so people are attributing her behaviors to that. I think it looks like the rules of evidence maybe are not being followed quite as closely as they should in that case, and so she's raining down terror about that. How do they get the discovery done in a case as complex as the one that you've described for the D.C., J6 case against Trump in any kind of a fashion that would allow them to try it next year, which is what they want?
Well, it's going to be very tough. I mean, you're going to have a lot of videotapes that need to be reviewed, audio tapes, electronic data. It's going to be very complex. And in the criminal context, the government is required to turn over a fair amount of material. It's not discovery like in the civil case where you take depositions and send a document request and you serve interrogatories. And there are certain rules for criminal cases. Essentially, everything that the prosecution has regarding this is supposed to be turned over. And the government's file may be quite voluminous, and they have to turn over anything that's even potentially exculpatory. So, I don't see how it gets done, you know, in the next 3-4 months. Forget the length of trial. I don't see how it could possibly get done, you know, particularly, I don't know if Trump's using the same lawyers he's using in the other cases, but these are things that normally would be probably on a year-plus track for cases of this complexity.
And when you say a year-plus track, you mean that the discovery phase would be a year, and then you would get to the actual trial phase?
Well, that's right, that from the time the judge sets the trial, it probably could be a year before it would go to trial in a case of this complexity, maybe more. That would put us right in the fall of 2024. What could be worse than that? Assuming he's the nominee. If he's not the nominee, then I'm not sure it really matters. And I guess we'll know that by June, next June. So, yeah, I mean, this would normally be not on a 3 or 4 month track for a case like this. It probably would be on like a year long track.
Wow.
And so, you know, and the judge is going to have to make some legal decisions. I'm sure there will be briefing and there'll be motions trying to get parts of the case thrown out. I don't know that they'll get the entire case thrown out, but maybe a couple of these counts that I think are stretches legally as to what the prosecution's trying to do. And this is a prosecutor, Jack Smith, who has been reversed by the U.S. Supreme Court, has been reversed by other courts for stretching the legal theories. The most famous was Governor Bob McDonnell in Virginia on a fraud of services type of theory that the Supreme Court ultimately rejected. But of course, by the time Bob McDonnell was vindicated, it was too late. He missed his chance to run for president because he'd been convicted on a trumped up charge of theft of services. And so, you know, this is very aggressive, and he has lost other cases where he's too aggressive. Now, it shouldn't wait till the Supreme Court to reverse him. A district court judge should not allow a prosecutor to do this, but unfortunately, a lot of district court judges do. So even if Trump is convicted in these various cases, it may not hold up on appeal, but that's 2, 3, 4 years from now. By then, who knows what will have happened to our country and to our political process. I think that, you know, if you're going to bring a charge against a presidential candidate in a presidential candidacy year, I mean, it's next year, but it's really already started. Mm-hmm. You have to have an ironclad case. You have to have an open and shut case. You should not have cases where you're stretching the legal theories, which is what they're doing in all these cases, except the Florida one is much more straightforward. But in New York, they've certainly stretched it. In D.C., they've stretched the legal theories. And what we hear about is going to happen in Georgia is a stretch of a legal theory. And that's not what you do during a presidential year to the leading contender, maybe not the nominee ultimately, but certainly the leading contender now for the presidency. You have to have a super strong case. And I don't see it in Manhattan. And based on this indictment, I don't see that super strong case. That's not to say they can't keep the case alive and get it to trial, but this should not be happening in the middle of a presidential election cycle.
And so what is the recourse for that? Is there no one who can step in and say that, you know, this has to wait until it's just basically up to the judge? He drew a bad judge for him, right? And so because of that, you know, his luck is against him, and that's it. And that's, in my opinion, what the Democrats were counting on. The chance of him drawing a bad judge in D.C. is much higher than if they had tried him in another jurisdiction where it's a little friendlier to him, or he might have had a Trump appointee somewhere in the mix. I don't think he has any Trump appointees on the D.C. Circuit. But what else is there that could possibly happen that could right this ship? Because we've not seen a sitting president have his Department of Justice or special prosecutor try a case against the opposition candidate who's running in the primary. We've never seen this before. It's just not done in America. You don't prosecute your political opponents. Yet here we are.
Yeah, the chance that an appeals court or the Supreme Court is going to, in a normal case, get involved in what happens during the trial and what happens with it is very small. I mean, they normally don't get involved. It's you have to go to a verdict and a judgment and an appeal, but they don't, you know, get involved while the trial's going on. That's something the district court judge, a trial judge, has great discretion in how to run his or her courtroom. But this is an unusual circumstance, so I'm not sure if the normal rules are going to apply. You know, if a judge were to order Donald Trump, assuming he's the nominee for the Republican Party, they were to order him to go to trial in September 2024, and he runs to the appeals court. In a normal case, the appeals court would say, you know, wait, we're not getting involved. Would an appeals court say, wait a second, in this unprecedented circumstance, will we get involved and order a district court judge to wait until after the election? I don't know. So this is going to test a lot of the norms that we have for how trials are run, because it's just not normal. As you indicated, this just doesn't happen. I can't recall a case where it happened during a presidential cycle that the, you know, the Department of Justice under one of the political candidates indicts the other leading political candidate. So maybe a court of appeals or the Supreme Court will get involved. Now, they're not going to micromanage the trial. The Supreme Court's not going to, you know, get involved in which evidence comes in and which witnesses can testify. But on something as big as, are you going to put a presidential candidate on trial 6 weeks before an election? Maybe they will. Maybe they will.
Well, I'm just trying to think of what other means there would be, because so it shouldn't be that a candidate or forget about candidates. It shouldn't be that a person who is being tried for a crime, which they are presumed innocent in this country. This is still America. You're innocent until you're proven guilty. So an innocent person would have to bear up under the charges in a case while also running to be the president of the United States. And you mentioned that, you know, he's not yet the nominee. Carrie Lake sent out an email demanding, you know, recommending to all of the other candidates that they simply throw their support to Trump because of what's happening to him, to present a unified front as Americans, as opposed to, obviously, this is a political contest. And so, you know, I can think of candidates who would probably seriously consider doing that because of their outrage. But I can also think of a few people who are running. The only reason they're running is to criticize Trump. And so why would they, you know, throw their support to him? They don't support him and they never will. So the likelihood of them all doing that is pretty slim. But if the field were to slim down significantly and he were to be the presumed nominee, then that would accelerate the Democrats' desire to influence the election by having him convicted, because it would, you know, basically move their timeline up. Right now, they're trying to thread the needle to get it done within that time frame so that he can be convicted close enough to the end of the primary so he either can't be the nominee or he can't run at all.
Well, the Democrats understand that these indictments have helped Trump become the nominee. So, you know, if they're smart and if they're strategic, the ploy would be do what you can to boost him to be the nominee, knowing that these trials are going to come down and potentially, in the minds of most people, ruin him as a general election candidate. So So this is a very dangerous thing. And they are manipulating the Republican electorate and manipulating the natural inclination that most Republicans have to rally around a candidate who's under attack from the Democrat government. So this is really so manipulative. You know, if you're a DeSantis supporter or, you know, somebody else supporting somebody else who's not Trump in the Republican field, you should be pretty angry at this, because this is, you know, has sucked all the media attention, has sucked all the wind, has caused people to rally around Trump that otherwise wouldn't have happened, and is really depriving you as a Republican voter of your meaningful potential candidates. If you look at the charts, like at Real Clear Politics, of the polling averages, as it moved into January, February, the race had tightened significantly. Trump was still up by double digits, but very low double digits, like 12%, 13% mm-hmm. over DeSantis. It had closed dramatically since last fall. Then the Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan indictment, comes down, and you see the lines separate instantaneously, dramatically, and Trump goes up to a 25, 30-point lead, and he's been there ever since. So this was, you know, these are the Democrat prosecutors manipulating the Republican primaries in order to both help Trump be the nominee, but hurt him when he is the nominee and he's in a general election. This is complete manipulation. And whether you support Trump as a Republican or you support somebody else, you should be pretty angry about what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty angry about all of it. But what's their plan B? What if we woke up tomorrow and, you know, God forbid, because I do think Trump deserves a chance to run against Biden in 2024. But what if we woke up tomorrow or next week on Monday and you had, you know, it was DeSantis at 55%. I don't actually think they want to run against DeSantis either. They can't indict him. They can't, you know, he's a Republican. He's doing very well in Florida. And he would make Joe Biden look even older than he really is, because DeSantis is actually really young. He's very sharp and, you know, he has a grand grasp of the issues that are facing the country right now. So all of the air is in the room. It is focused on Trump. What would they do if it was DeSantis?
Well, of course, they'd be viciously attacking him, but they just couldn't do it with the Department of Justice. So, I think that the notion that Ron DeSantis supporters are happy about these indictments, I think, is the exact opposite of reality. I mean, I think people who wanted there to be a legitimate Republican contest, a real contest between two candidates, have recognized that these indictments have come close to, I'm not saying it's eliminated, I think there's a lot of time, but have really manipulated the Republican primaries. And so, you know, if it were Ron DeSantis up by 30 points, you know, I don't know if the feds and the media would be as excited about indicting Donald Trump.
Yeah. I mean, I have my doubts. I think there's a certain impetus within the Democrat Party ever since the lock her up chance. They've wanted to put Trump in jail. And I think they if they could do it, if they could pull it off, they would. They'd be able to say only president to ever go to jail, you know, was a Republican. And they would, you know, use that to tar and feather anyone who used to support Trump and to vilify them. But there is a weird... But when you say it's being manipulated, it's the kind of thing that turns into gaslighting, because you can't be sure of what the alternative would be. It's not clear. And normally in a political contest, you look at one candidate and you can extrapolate, this person would do this, this candidate would be that, their reaction to this would be that. But in this case, we can't do that because everything's so skewed, because it's all unprecedented, it's all new, it's all uncharted.
Yeah, and I think we need to see how it plays out. I don't think Trump necessarily will be the nominee. I mean, certainly, if you look at the current polling, you know, looks good for him. But there's a long way to go, and a lot of that polling is a rally around effect. And DeSantis's rollout of his campaign wasn't great. I mean, let's face it. But I do agree that the Democrats would much rather run against Trump than they would rather run against DeSantis or, well, maybe not the other Republicans. I think DeSantis is the one they fear. And every now and then, they say the quiet part out loud. And every now and then you'll hear some Democrat pundit. There must be the memo must have gone out to Democrats. Don't say this out loud. But every now and then one of them will say it out loud, which is they want to run against Trump. That's the one they want to run against because they know it will get their base excited. They will turn out millions of voters who maybe wouldn't care, would stay home, not mail in their ballot. Millions, maybe tens of millions who will turn out, and Democrats know it, to vote against Trump. And so every now and then a Democrat, operative will say the quiet part out loud, which is Trump is the one they want to run against. Now, of course, they wanted that in 2016 and it didn't work out for them. But, you know, there was somebody on that ticket who the Republicans crawled over broken glass to vote against, and that's Hillary Clinton. So Hillary Clinton as a motivator, was similar to how Trump is a motivator for Democrats to turn out to vote. So, like I said, every now and then the Democrat operatives will let leak that they really do want to run against Trump.
Yeah, well, they want to run against him because they hate him, and they think they have a foolproof operation for taking him out. They don't have a foolproof plan for taking out another Republican candidate. So I will agree with you there. I think Republicans will crawl over broken glass, hot volcanic ash, thorn bushes to vote for Trump. And they have the same fervor for voting against Biden. But there's a lot of other things at play that impact that. It's not just Republicans voting. We would need some other parts of the electorate to join in. And I think there's quite a few people who are moderates who don't like Biden, but then there's the wild card. Like what will they do? Especially since the media has now sunken into that, like they now permeate the 6 p.m. news on local stations are now saying, very similar things to CNN and MSNBC. They're almost indistinguishable. You used to be able to turn on the news at night and it sounded a little bit normal. Now it sounds like you're listening to light CNN or light MSNBC. It's crazy. So, with that kind of operational control over the media, it's very tough to see what the right thing is, other than the witch hunt against Trump should be ended because it's unconstitutional and it's terrible. Because next time there's an election, now we have to worry about the Department of Justice charging the candidate they don't like with some kind of trumped up crime. That's un-American.
Yeah, I agree. And, if DeSantis is the candidate, I'm sure they'll try to cook something up. They always do, but not to the extent. I mean, Trump, to some extent, handed them, the ammunition to go after him,
How so?
Conduct after the election and, the documents in Florida. He made it easy for them. And that doesn't excuse them wanting to target him. That doesn't excuse the fact that he has been singled out, but he made their life easier than he needed to.
So help me understand that as we close out here, because this is another like legalese thing. My understanding is that as president, he had the right to declassify documents, and all of the presidents have had little tussles with the National Archives over what they're storing and where they're storing it, and how the National Archives are going to manage their documents. What is it that Trump did that went against, his blanket ability to declassify as a former president?
Well, his argument, which the court's going to have to decide, but I don't think it's valid, is the mere taking of documents is an act of declassification as president, as opposed to actually going through some process to declassify them. And there is the Navy, the attack plans for Iran, which he admitted on audio during an interview he had not declassified. So that's the classification issue. A lot of people cite the Presidential Records Act and say, oh, well, that allows him to take whatever he wants. Well, I've read that act. No, it doesn't. It doesn't say that at all. And the statute he's charged under, which is a little bit controversial, it's the so-called Espionage Act, which does not mean espionage in the way we normally think of it. It's the mishandling of national defense information which if revealed would jeopardize the national security of the U.S. So those are the charge. That's part of the charge. Okay, and that's the more controversial charge. And that, those are the charges that are maybe a little bit weaker in my estimation, but at least as to that Iran attack plan, he's on audio saying, I didn't declassify this. I could have, but I didn't. So that's very, very damaging. And he knew he was being recorded. This wasn't like a secret government recording. This was an interview with some people writing a book, and he knew it was being recorded, and he admitted to that. But I think then you have the obstruction of justice charges, where they allege that when he knew that records had been subpoenaed, he coordinated and colluded with employees and directed them to essentially hide documents from their own lawyers who were gathering documents to turn over to the feds. And they added a charge that he actually instructed some of the employees to erase surveillance tape. Now, they never ended up erasing it. I think they didn't know how to do it. But if it's true what they allege, and of course, these are just claims, that he instructed them, he conspired to obstruct justice by instructing them to delete surveillance tape. So, that's why I say the Florida case, and I said this last March, I said the Florida case is the biggest risk to Trump because it's things that people can understand. It's, taking documents. There's a legal argument over whether he was entitled to. I think he's going to lose that argument, but there's a legal argument. But once a judge rules that he had no right to take those documents, then the rest of the evidence is simple because they just come in with evidence that he had them on the Navy, on the Iran attack plan document. They've got the audio recording, and on the obstruction of justice charges, presumably they have witnesses who will testify to these things. We don't know that. Maybe they can't prove any of this. But I'm saying the Florida one, if the conduct of his as alleged is true, is a fairly simple case, unlike these other ones, which are much more complex legally and much more complex factually. And so I think Florida is the real risk to him.
And what is the punishment if he's convicted on the Florida case, the documents case?
Yeah, well, I would have to check those statutes. I don't remember what the maximum sentence is. I mean, clearly, at their maximum, you're talking, for somebody who's almost 80 years old, like the equivalent of life in prison. Now, what a judge would actually sentence him to is an entirely different matter. So I don't know if he were to be convicted in Florida, it might depend which charges it was. Some might be more serious than others. But, when you're 80 years old, even a year in jail could be a life sentence.
Right. Well, and obviously, I can't believe that he would be convicted on this, because does intent not play a role at all?
Well, it might in terms of if we're talking about the Florida case,
case.
Knowingly, he would have to knowingly, do these actions. But intent, I guess I'm just thinking out loud here, as to the obstruction would probably, yes, you would have to show an intent to obstruct, not that you, negligently forgot to do something, but that you intended to prevent these documents from being turned over to the feds. And, I think the question a lot of people have is, okay, he took them with him. He has not been charged for any of the documents he took and gave back to the government. I mean, I think that's an important point. I'm sympathetic to him, but I'm also trying to be realistic with people when I give my analysis of these cases. He has not been charged. So the documents he's being charged for are the ones he took with him, and when the Fed subpoenaed them and tried to get them back, he hid from them, according to them. That's the allegation. So that's why I say he handed them something on a silver platter that he didn't need to. If he had just given them back when they asked for them, he probably wouldn't be charged in Florida. I mean, that's just the reality of it. And I have no sympathy for the Department of Justice. Believe me, I'm not sympathetic to the FBI either. But that is the reality here. He created a situation in Florida that left him very vulnerable to prosecution and to criminal charges by a Department of Justice intent on charging him. And he handed them their case on a silver platter. And, now it's a problem for him. And his defenses are fairly I think, controversial legal claims as to what he's allowed to take, et cetera. But even if he was allowed to take them, if he knew these documents were under subpoena, why weren't they turned over? Why were boxes moved? These are things that are going to have to be defended. And I'm not saying he should be found guilty. I'm just saying it, Florida is a problem case for him. And I've been saying this since last March before, you know, before we're in our current situation.
So if they have a case like that, that they feel they can actually prosecute and defend, why are they lobbing all of these other cases at him? It's, I guess, you know, just pile it all on because they hope one thing sticks or it's just open season. I mean, there's so many cases, so many accusations.
This is the mindset of the Democrats. I mean, you had prosecutors running for office like Alvin Bragg on a platform of getting Donald Trump. It's sick. It shouldn't happen in our society that prosecutors run on that. The attorney general of the state of New York, Letitia James, ran on a platform. We've put the video on our website many times. Ran on a platform that I'm not only going to get Trump, I'm going to get his family. And this is how dangerous these Democrat prosecutors are. And they're reflective of an attack totalitarian mentality in the Democrat Party when it comes to use of the police powers and the prosecutorial powers. So why are they piling on? They're piling on because they can, or they think they can. And that's really scary.
It is. It really is. Well, I appreciate you bringing, it's an amazing amount of information. There's a lot to absorb. It's extraordinarily upsetting. Americans are feeling very put upon and put out by this happening during the election season. The honorable thing to have done would have been to adjudicate these things before the primary season opened up so that people could move on and make a clear choice. There's something really dastardly about the way this is being done. And I think a lot of Americans hate it and are going to have a bad taste in their mouth for the Democrats, no matter what the outcome of these cases is. I feel like people should be walking away from a group of people who would behave this way. There's no honor in this. But I do appreciate your time here tonight, and I was so excited to have you. We hope to talk to you again. Professor William Jacobson, founder of one of our favorite websites, it's legalinsurrection.com, legalinsurrection.com. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Great. It was great being on. Take care.
All right. Take care. Oh, wow. That was unbelievably informative. If you have questions or what have you, 866-95-PATRIOT. Lots to unpack there. We will be right back with more.